MechCast, Saturday, December 5th, 2020. This episode of the MechCast is sponsored by SanDisk. Visit sandisk.com/MechCast. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Glad to have you back here with me. It is December already. Can you believe it? We're already into December, moving into the holiday season, and soon a whole new year. But that doesn't mean that things have slowed down in the world of Apple and Macintosh and iOS devices and news. We have just a packed show today. We have a lot of things to get into in this episode. We're going to be talking about rumors for new iPads, iPad Pros, talking about updates that might be coming to iPhones, following up on some M1 Mac information, some new Apple Silicon Mac information, and news and rumors and all that fun stuff. We're going to talk about Apple Fitness Plus, couple new Apple products on the way, maybe one more in 2020. Of course, Apple TV Plus getting some new shows and reports of some issues with iPhone 12s out there, and hopefully we can help you out with those. So that is all just in the news for this week. And then we're going to get to some reactions from the community about Apple new Silicon Macs. Also talk about podcasts and how you might migrate those with the new Big Sur that's out there, get into devices and notifications, answer some listener questions, talk about screenshots and clean installs, and I also have a thing of the moment in this episode. So like I said, lots of things to get into in this episode. It should be a really good one, but before we dive into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and I think you're going to like this one because it's a podcast from Wondery, Business Wars. Tech entrepreneurs are in an all-out race to cash in on our collective addiction to social media. It's a fight that started in Silicon Valley that's now gone global. In the newest season of Wondery's Business Wars, TikTok versus Instagram, they track the war between the two social media giants. Within the last couple years, TikTok has become one of the most popular apps around the world. It's even garnered the power to completely reinvent the music industry. And despite political constraints the app has recently faced, TikTok has managed to pose a serious threat to its American counterpart, Instagram. This season of Business Wars will touch on the history behind and founding of both apps and what they've done in recent years to become two of the largest social media platforms to exist. I started listening to the show and I am really enjoying the backstory behind these companies and their rise to prominence. I'm learning a lot of things about the two that I had no idea about. And I'm also a really big fan of documentaries and docuseries. And I have to tell you, the storytelling and recreations that they do in Business Wars is really sucking me into the show. I'm finding it to be very entertaining and a lot of fun. Listen to the latest season of Business Wars, TikTok versus Instagram, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. And a big thank you to Wondery and Business Wars for their support of the MacCast. As I mentioned at the top of the show, we have a lot of news to cover this week. We're going to start off with iPad Pros. We've been talking for a little while now about the rumors of a new iPad Pro version getting a mini LED display in 2021. We're still hearing those rumors. I think they started with Ming-Chi Kuo. That update is expected to happen sometime here in the first quarter of 2021, and it's expected to probably be an option on a new high-end iPad Pro, probably launching sometime around March. Well, this week, a Korean site, The Elec, says that later in 2021, there's going to be another iPad Pro update. And in this one, they claim that Apple will ship the first iPad Pro models with OLED displays. They say that both Samsung and LG are already in the process of developing OLED displays for the iPad Pro. And we'll have to see if that comes to fruition. Apple typically has been doing the iPad Pro update in the spring around March. So you would expect that to be the main one for the year, but sounding like they could come up with some new models in the second half of 2021 as well, if these rumors turn out to be true. We've also been hearing that next year's iPad models may up the game in terms of wireless connectivity, specifically cellular connectivity. They may also get 5G with mmWave support. This is according to DigiTimes. They cite that Apple has had success recently in developing its own in-house mmWave antenna and package modules for next year's iPhones, and that those are going so well that they're likely going to spill over into next year's iPad models. So again, we'll have to wait and see, but it's looking like 2021 is going to shape up to be a pretty good year for the iPad Pro. Apple leaker John Prosser claims that Apple is going to have new iPhone models next year without any ports whatsoever. At least one model, he claims, will have no ports. Which model? He doesn't really say, but Apple is expected to keep the same four model lineup in 2021, the iPhone Mini, iPhone, iPhone Pro, and iPhone Pro Max. So my guess, and a lot of folks' guesses, is that it will be the iPad Pro Max. Apple tends to kind of bring new features to the top-of-the-line models. Although, you know, pros, they kind of like their ports. So you could also maybe argue going with the Mini and having the consumer model be a little more simplified, not have the ports in there. As far as how you would handle connectivity, I would assume it would either rely on 100% wireless connectivity, so Bluetooth and the latest Wi-Fi, or I would guess Apple could build or add some technology. We've been hearing about this a little bit into the MagSafe connector, and they could go through MagSafe, maybe add something like a smart connector in there to add, you know, somewhat of a physical connectivity, but without a port. The smart connector seems like the way that they might go, especially considering that we've been hearing about rumors of different models of iPhones with smart connectors on them. So I'm guessing that Apple's been playing around with options and technology, or options around that technology, for a couple years now. So that could be the way they get into a portless iPhone. Be curious to know what you think about an iPhone with no ports. I think it's a natural, like, next step with where Apple has been going. It's kind of been the dream to always have devices that don't have any wires going into them, and this could be the start of that. We've also seen additional reports recently from sources like ET News that Apple is looking to increase the optical zoom feature in the cameras on future iPhones using what is called periscope lens technology. Basically, it's like a set of lenses that are inside the iPhone body at a 90 degree angle to the main lens with a 45 degree mirror. And so what that enables them to do is have a long set of lenses, and they could potentially achieve up to a 10x optical zoom without making the phone any thicker or needing any kind of protruding or telescoping lens assembly on the back of the iPhone itself. Right now, the tech is not expected to show up in an iPhone until 2022 by most rumors, but there are a few people out there that are saying that Apple could try to get it in 2021. I guess one of the issues is that Samsung is the main developer of this technology, or kind of has exclusive rights to this technology. So they have some of their model phones that already have this, and that they may hold that close so that Apple can't catch up to some of their camera technologies. So Apple will have to work with Samsung on this one, but could be that we could start to see a much better optical zoom in future iPhones by 2021, probably more likely in 2022. The new Apple Silicon M1 Max are very, very cool. They're getting a lot of praise, as you know, for their performance, for them literally sipping battery and staying cool, which is all really great things, but they kind of have one limitation versus some of their Intel counterparts, and that is in display connectivity. Natively, the new M1 Macs are somewhat limited for external displays. The M1 MacBook Air and the M1 MacBook Pro can run one external display with up to a 6K resolution at 60 Hz. The M1 Mac Mini does a little bit better. It can run one display up to 6K resolution at 60 Hz connected via the Thunderbolt connector, and one display up to 4K resolution at 60 Hz via the HDMI connector because it has that extra connection on there. Well, it turns out that there may be a little bit of a way around that limitation. A YouTuber, Ruslan Tulipov, showed that it's possible to use an M1 Mac Mini to drive up to 6 displays. The trick requires using DisplayPort adapters with DisplayLink. What he was able to do is take a MacBook Air and a MacBook Pro to drive up to 5 displays and up to 6 displays with the Mac Mini. So you're using the native connectivity or with the Mac Mini, the HDMI port, and then DisplayPort to drive all of these other displays. The MacBook Air, MacBook Pro, you're using DisplayPort via Thunderbolt to connect up to 6 displays. He was able to use a mix of 4K and 1080p displays and noted that the Mac's Thunderbolt ports just don't have enough bandwidth to simultaneously run 6 4K displays at full resolution. So you'll have to play around with the resolutions and the combinations that you're using, but he did note that even with 6 displays connected, he was still able to get very good performance even under load. So there is a solution out there if you need more displays with your M1 Mac Minis, and you can get them to work using this little trick. So that's good news. Obviously, Apple started with some consumer-level displays, so I don't know how many people are going to have a need for this, but it's pretty interesting. It's a pretty interesting kind of little parlor trick that he was able to pull off. And, you know, if you do want to do it, hey, you have a way to do it now. So it does get around one of those limitations. Of course, we're expecting future Apple Silicon Macs, additional Mac Pros and probably iMacs and iMac Pros and Mac Pros in the future to have newer chips and more support for more connectivity. And speaking of those future models, it's looking like a new MacBook Pro or new MacBook models could be coming out in the second half of 2021. And according to Ming-Chi Kuo, they are going to have an all new design. So are we ready for a new design of MacBook Pro? I don't know how much different they can get than their current configuration, but we can expect some usually great things from Apple. Also, another leaker, Love to Dream, on Twitter says that they're not just going to go with new Apple Silicon MacBook Pros or MacBook models, that there still will be some models that are going to be offering up Intel options. And I think that is going to be something that Apple will continue to do for this next year for all of their models while they're in transition. Apple has said they're going to take about 2 years to transition fully over to Apple Silicon. So I think there's some folks out there that just need Intel for one reason or another. And it makes sense for Apple to keep that in the lineup. Now, Ming-Chi Kuo also said that Apple is going to have a more affordable new MacBook Air sometime in 2022 with a mini LED display on it. So mini LED obviously becoming a thing for Apple. We're expecting them to put it in MacBook Pros, MacBooks, possibly iMacs, certainly iPad Pros in 2021. All of these things are coming. So that's the technology Apple has been playing around with and working on for a while. Sounds like 2021 could be the year of the mini LED display. Developer Alexander Graf was able to successfully virtualize ARM for Windows to run on an M1 Mac without using emulation. Ever since Apple announced the Apple Silicon Macs, it's been wondered if we would see Windows running on an M1 Mac, and it looks like he was actually able to do it. He says it works with near native performance. Even better than that, he says that the OS can successfully run x86 applications, quote, pretty well. Not like Intel apps on Rosetta, but pretty good, according to the developer. Of course, that shows promise if and only if Microsoft would actually license ARM for Windows to users. Right now, it's only available to OEMs as a pre-installed option, so you can't just go out and buy a copy of ARM for Windows. But if you could, it would likely run on Apple Silicon Macs. It's really looking like that would be the case. Craig Federighi actually had already said in an interview that Windows on Apple Silicon was really, quote, up to Microsoft. So I have a feeling that this could happen, especially since we're also hearing rumors that AMD is working on M1 processors, that they're getting close to being ready within months, according to some reports, and they're trying to put something out there that's going to compete with the Apple Silicon. Of course, they're going to need a version of Windows to run on it, so hopefully that means Microsoft will consider opening up to users and not just selling it through the computer, manufacturers. We will just have to wait and see on that one. Of course, there's another operating system that many folks may want to run on M1 Macs, especially Linus Torvalds, and that is Linux. He said in an interview that he would love to move back to an Apple M1 MacBook Air. He used to run a MacBook Air, but kind of left it because it didn't perform as well as he wanted. Of course, a new MacBook Air performs amazingly well, and if he could get a version of Linux running on an M1 Mac, he says he'd totally go for it. In the interview, he noted that the GPU and support from Apple are largely the sticking points, and he doubted that Apple would ever provide enough details on the M1 silicon on a chip design for Linux developers to actually be able to develop an operating system or a kernel to support it. Turns out, not long after that interview, though, that it's not going to stop at least one Linux developer, Hector Martin, from trying. He has set up a Patreon page to bring Linux to M1 Macs. So he is definitely going to give it a shot. He's been successful at reverse engineering Linux distributions on to other kinds of devices, so he definitely has the experience. The project has already reached its kickoff goal and is about 60% of the way to making it to a goal for Martin to be able to do the development as a full-time job. Good news is that the project will be open source and the code will be made available on GitHub. So if you'd like to support that, I have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. So I think we could see Linux also on M1 Macs in the future. Of course, Apple could always throw roadblocks in and shut either of these initiatives down. I don't really see them doing that. I don't think they're incentivized to doing that. It's going to help them sell more machines. Why not? But we'll have to just stand back, wait, and see. Definitely think that Microsoft will eventually bring Windows to M1 Macs. Apple's always had a pretty good relationship with Microsoft, so I could see that happening. And the Linux community, obviously amazing. They're going to step up, and I have no doubt that they can potentially reverse engineer this thing. I was actually surprised when Linus Torvalds said that he didn't think it would happen. But leave it up to the community, and I think they will get it done. Looks like Apple has started teasing its new Fitness Plus service, or at least their instructors are, on Instagram. Apple has actually not said when the service will be available, beyond stating that it will happen in late 2020. Obviously, it's the beginning of December, so we're getting pretty close to that deadline. It's feeling like it's right around the corner, especially if Apple Marketing is having those instructors kind of plug the service on Instagram. If you don't remember, Apple Fitness Plus is going to offer video fitness training sessions led by their own in-house team of instructors. The service is going to integrate with the Apple Watch to display heads-up fitness stats over the fitness videos. Apple Fitness Plus will cost $9.99 per month US, or $79 per year, and is also included in the Apple One Premier Bundle. Apple Fitness Plus may be a surprise hit, I think, with the current COVID environment and a lot of gyms being closed. And also because the Apple Watch apparently is selling in droves. There's a lot of people out there with brand new Apple Watches, at least according to the latest numbers from IDC. IDC claims that Apple shipped 11.8 million Apple Watches in the third quarter of 2020. That's up 75% from the number shipped in the third quarter of 2029. IDC believes that Apple has about a 21.6% share of the worldwide wrist-worn wearables market. That's a little bit of a tongue twister right there, putting it in second place behind Xiaomi. But you have to remember that this is all wrist-worn wearables. So not just watches, it includes all of those little cheap, simple fitness trackers. And Xiaomi sells a ton of those things. So Apple making a huge dent in the wearables market for sure. And I think that's only going to help them when it comes to their services, especially services that are focused around fitness. So excited to see how Apple Fitness Plus does for Apple. But again, I think the current environment is going to really help them with that. Another thing in Apple services that happened this week that's pretty exciting, Apple Family Sharing has now finally added support for in-app purchases and subscription sharing, and developers can now enable that. So they can now enable family sharing for auto-renewable subscriptions and non-consumable in-app purchases. This would allow users to share their purchases with up to 5 family members. That is great news, something we've been waiting for Apple to roll out for a while. Again, developers will have to opt into those options, which I think is the right way to go. But if they do, you can enable it now in the settings by going into settings, clicking on your Apple ID, going under the subscriptions, and you will now see there is a new option for share new subscriptions that you can toggle on. And then within the individual apps in the subscriptions section, you can tap on the subscription to see if the Apple supports it. If it does, there'll be a new option to toggle on subscription sharing for that app. And that is pretty cool. Also, the fact that you have in-app purchases that are non-consumable also being able to be shared across family members. So very excited with that news. It finally means, I think, that my wife and I will separate our individual account for iTunes, because we've been sharing some in-app purchases and stuff like that. And hopefully a lot of the apps, and actually I already kind of checked, a lot of the apps that I do use that I have subscriptions for are already opting into it. Of course, some aren't, and that is totally fine. They offer their own sort of family options that are a little more pricey, but happy to pay that to support certain developers. So it'll go developer by developer, but good news nonetheless. Apple's MagSafe Duo chargers are now out and available. Everybody was kind of wondering what the price was going to be. We now know they are $129 US. This is Apple's new device that will let you charge an iPhone and an Apple Watch at the same time. It has a nice foldable, portable design. It actually looks pretty slick. Unfortunately, that $129 isn't really going to get you everything that you need. Yep, just like the iPhones and iPads, it does not come with a USB-C power adapter. You're going to have to purchase that separately. And actually, depending upon how much charging speed you want for the iPhone portion, you're going to need to adapt your power adapter appropriately. I think we already talked about this a little bit, but if you get a 20-watt Apple charger, that will charge the iPhone at the 11 watt rate. If you want to go faster than that, you're going to have to bump up to the MacBook Pro USB-C charger for the MacBook, or the MacBook Air rather, I guess, the MacBook Air USB-C charger at 27 watts, and that will charge your iPhone with Apple's new MagSafe Duo charger at the 14 watt rate, which is almost the full 15 watt rate that is available. So just be aware of that. If you are purchasing one of those, you probably want to pick up a power brick. There's actually some great third-party options. I just ordered a couple of 20 watt chargers from Anchor, and I'm looking forward to getting those in, and I will share my thoughts and opinions on those on a future episode of the MacCast. I needed one, actually, for my new MagSafe charger. I actually ordered one of those thinking that I would just use a USB-C charger, either the one from my MacBook or another device, and then realized, I really want to have a dedicated one for it. So that's on order. Hopefully that'll be coming soon. And I guess that's a new thing, right? So it's great that Anchor makes a lot of different options, and they're really, really great. So check those out if you're looking for an alternative to what Apple has to offer. The iPhone 12s have been out for a few months now, and unfortunately, it looks like we're starting to see a little bit of issues with at least some customers' iPhones. Both 9 to 5 Mac and Mac Rumors are reporting on an issue related to excessive battery drain on iPhone 12 models when on standby. They report the issue is happening even when on Wi-Fi and with 5G turned off. Some users are reporting a loss of up to 4% battery life per hour when in standby, which is a little bit excessive, certainly faster than you would expect. Not really sure what's going on here, but it's looking like it's probably something related to software. One thing I noticed recently with my own iPhone is California finally opted into or enabled the ability to do contact tracing on the iPhone. So I enabled the new exposure notification feature. And after I read this report, I went into my settings into battery to look at the battery life to see what apps were actually draining my battery. And I noticed that the exposure notification app is the second most battery intensive app running on my iPhone right now. I noticed it was using about 11% of my battery over the past 10 days. And I have noticed that my battery does seem to be depleting a little bit faster than normal. I think also I'm having a similar issue that was also reported, which is that some iPhones are losing their Qi wireless charging ability. So I use some third-party Qi wireless charging pucks from Anker. Like I said, I just got the new MagSafe one. I haven't started using that yet. And I have noticed a few times that I'll wake up in the morning and my phone is not charged. What has been being reported is that some iPhones reportedly suddenly stop charging and refuse to charge on Qi wireless chargers. Now, hard rebooting the iPhone seems to bring everything back, and I actually had to do that once with my device, and it started charging up again, but you can also lose it again. These reports are coming from 9 to 5 Mac. They say that Apple is aware of the issue. They had at least one person in their community who called up Apple, and the Apple rep said, yep, our engineers are aware of it, and they are working on it, so hopefully there will be a fix for that one sometime soon as well. And then another little issue that we're hearing about in the community is some users are reporting the sudden loss of 5G and LTE connectivity. This would be even in places where they had that connectivity previously. Not really sure what's going on here or if it's limited to certain carriers or certain devices, but it sounds like for the interim, in the meantime, if you're experiencing this issue, toggling airplane mode off or on rather, and then turning it back off again seems to resolve the issue. So it's looking like it might be an issue with handoffs between cellular towers, something that I've struggled with on my iPhone in the past as well. I haven't really noticed that with my new iPhone 12 Pro, but again, just something to be aware of that's going on if you have a new iPhone 12. And then finally, one other issue related to iPhone 11s this time. Apple has launched a new iPhone 11 display replacement program. They say to address a problem that a small percentage of iPhone users are experiencing. In these cases, the display of the iPhone stops responding to touch input. Apple says that affected devices were manufactured between November 2019 and May 2020, and the issue seems to be related to the display module that will need to be replaced. There's actually a serial number checker in the support document on Apple's website. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, so you can plug in your device's serial number if you have an iPhone 11, see if your device is eligible for the replacement program. If so, devices can be taken to Apple or an Apple-authorized service provider to be serviced at no charge, and the program will cover affected iPhone 11 devices for up to 2 years after the first retail sale of the unit. And those who have already paid for their devices to be repaired because of this issue can actually contact Apple about a refund. So if you want to check out that program, again, I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. And just when we thought Apple might be done with all of their new product announcements for 2020, there might be one more thing. Mac Rumors has gotten their hands on an internal memo from what they say is a, quote, reliable source that tells service provider technicians to, quote, prepare for a new product, for new product SKUs, new updated product descriptions, and new updated product pricing, arriving next week on Tuesday around 5:30 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. So this would be Tuesday, December 8th. Speculation is that Apple might be getting ready to release one more product before the end of the year. As far as what it could be, speculation could go wild. Many people pointing to the AirPod Studios that we were supposed to see maybe at the last event. So the over-the-ear headphones. Also, AirTags are in the mix, and we had also been expecting possibly an updated or new Apple TV. Leaker Love to Dream also on Twitter had tweeted in the past that Apple would have one more, quote, Christmas surprise to come this year. So that could be what is coming. I have no idea what I think it is. Likely, if I were a betting man, I would say an updated Apple TV, maybe right here before the end of the year, but that is just my guess. I'd love to know what your guesses are. If you have a opinion on this, shoot me an email, send me a comment, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the news for this week, it's looking like Apple TV Plus is getting a couple of new docu-series. Apple TV Plus, according to Deadline, has given the order for a straight-to-series show hosted by Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea Clinton. This is a currently untitled series, but it will be inspired by the Clintons' book, The Book of Gutsy Women, Favorite Stories of Courage and Resilience. Apple has also reportedly ordered a 6-part docuseries for Apple TV Plus following the World Surf League. Apple says, quote, each episode will be a rich exploration of the characters who make up the 2021 WSL Men's and Women CT, taking viewers on a journey to incredible surfing locations across the globe. So if you're a surfing fan, that is one you might be looking forward to, and just a couple of new series that are coming to Apple TV Plus. And with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a moment again and thank a couple of show sponsors, starting with our friends at SanDisk. I want to talk to you again about their great iXpand line of drives, flash drives. You know, we all know how easy it is to run out of space on our iPhones. It's also an awful experience when you realize you have to delete photos or data right in the moment. You're in the middle of something, you run out of space, and that feeling of having to delete some is terrible. It's happened to me. I'm sure it's happened to you. Photos and videos, they can just pile up on our devices. We know it can happen. And waiting for those memories to upload to the cloud can take hours sometimes. Plus, you may have heard that Google Photos is ending their free and unlimited storage. So if you've been using that service, you need another alternative for where to take your photos. And that's why I'm excited to share with you the simple solution from SanDisk. Thumb drives that go into our computers, we're all familiar with those. SanDisk now has options that will cover you for your phone as well. The data storage solutions make it very easy to back up and transfer your photos and videos to your phone, especially all those precious memories that you're going to be making this holiday season. I've actually been using the iXpand flash drive with SanDisk with my devices, and I am loving it. It has a USB-A connector, so it plugs right into my Mac or your PC, if you have a PC, and it flips around, and on the other side, yep, a lightning port right on there. So I can plug it right into my iPhone, right into my iPad, and they even have the iXpand app that will do an auto backup of all your photos. It can actually copy all of your photos and videos right on to your drive. They also have a USB-C version that I've been using with my iPad Pro, and I absolutely love it. It's great for jumping into the Files app and just transferring documents. It just shows up right as you would expect it, like a device, and they have great storage options in the iXpand flash drive range from 128 to 256 gigabytes of storage, so plenty of storage to meet your needs. Take my advice, start freeing up space on your phone with SanDisk today. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order of featured SanDisk products, but only when you go to sandisk.com/Maccast. So don't wait, that's sandisk.com, sandisk.com/Maccast to get 15% off your first order of featured SanDisk products. And a huge thank you to SanDisk and iXpand for their support of the Maccast. And I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Headspace. You know, life can be stressful even under normal circumstances, and 2020 has challenged even the most difficult times in your life. You need stress relief that goes beyond quick fixes, and that's Headspace. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations in an easy-to-use app. Headspace's approach to mindfulness can reduce stress, improve sleep, boost focus, and increase your overall sense of well-being. I've actually tried different forms of meditation and relaxation techniques and never had very much success. But I opened up Headspace, and it was a really great experience. What I enjoyed about it was it asked me questions about what I wanted to gain from meditation. I actually chose focus, and it also asked me about my experience level, what time of day I wanted to do meditations and meditate, and for how long. And then it allowed me to say, hey, I'm a beginner. I'm new to this. I'm not very experienced at it. And it walked me through a series that takes just 3 minutes a day, and so far, it's been great. I've been really enjoying it. It's very easy to use, and the app has a great, cheery style that I think just makes it really, really fun. And oh, another thing I really like about it, it links into the Health app and to HealthKit, so I can track my progress, which is really, really cool. I'm also planning on trying out their Sleepcasts, which will probably help me battle my occasional bouts of insomnia, and it's been really, really fun. So Headspace makes it really easy for you to build a life-changing meditation practice with mindfulness that works for you on your schedule, anytime, anywhere. You deserve to feel happier, and Headspace is meditation made simple. So go to headspace.com/Maccast. That's headspace.com/Maccast for a free 1 month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal being offered right now, so head to headspace.com/Maccast today. And a big thank you to Headspace for their support of the Maccast. I don't know about you, but the more and more I read about Apple's M1, Apple Silicon Macs, the more excited I seem to get about them. And I have to tell you, I cannot tell you actually how many times I have had a new M1 MacBook Air in my cart on Apple.com or in the Apple app. I keep throwing it in there and configuring it. I don't need a new machine. I have a perfectly great new MacBook Pro 16-inch, and that's going to be my machine for a very, very long time. But I have to tell you, it is so tempting. I am fighting my Apple addiction very, very hard right now. So I need to live vicariously through you. And last week, I actually asked the community, hey, if you did get a new M1 Mac, and maybe this will just make it worse. I don't know. Maybe I need to think this through a little bit more. But still, I want to hear your stories. I want to hear if you got a new M1 Mac or if you've been able to play around with one, what your impressions are. I want to hear on the street, real world people reactions. And I asked for that last week. And of course, great community that you are, you delivered, and I received this message from Cole.
Hi, Adam. Cole here from Tampa, Florida. Last week, I upgraded my 12-inch MacBook to the new M1 MacBook Pro, and I set it up fully on battery power, nothing plugged in, all my different apps and email accounts, and I was done within 15 minutes. This process normally would have taken me like 30 minutes. And I glanced up at the battery percentage, and the widget said I had only dropped to 99%. So the machine is incredibly fast. The battery consumption is incredibly slow. I am so pleased just based on my initial first reaction on navigating the new environment with Big Sur. I mostly do layout in Word in my company with actually collaborative layout with a bunch of different people, and the machine just totally tears it apart. The 12-inch MacBook could barely even load those documents, and now I'm breezing through them in no time. I am so pleased. I can't wait to see how this machine will get better with time. And anyway, thanks for the show.
Hey, Cole, thank you for sharing your experience. I really, really appreciate it. That's just amazing. I love to hear the excitement in your voice. You get a new machine and having that experience, especially the amazing experience that people are having with these M1 machines, it's really, really cool to hear firsthand. So I appreciate you sending in that message. Yeah, again, I think it's going to make it harder for me to avoid pressing that button and getting my own M1 MacBook Air, but I don't need it. I just need to keep reminding myself that these are great machines. I'm looking so forward to hearing more and more of your stories. So if you have had an experience like Cole's, or even if you've had an alternate experience, if you think this is not the machine for you, I want to hear from you too. Like, what are the opinions in the community? But overall, it's seeming like Apple has really created a generational change here. Really, they flipped the script. They changed the game. We already talked a little bit earlier about how the fact that the other processor developers, AMD specifically, are scrambling to catch up, although they're kind of hedging their bets and saying, hey, we were already on this. We have something planned. It's going to be around the corner very soon. It's going to be interesting to see if they can really pull off the same thing that Apple is doing here. And I think where they're not going to be able to pull it off is the fact that they have to support so many manufacturers, and there's just a lot of more variables that they have to deal with. Apple being able to control the hardware and the software is just something no one is going to be able to catch up to. So it'll be interesting to see how that performs. But until then, we have Apple Silicon. I want to continue to be talking about it. And again, I want to hear your real world experiences, especially if you've picked one up and you're really doing some heavier tasks with it. If you're pushing it to its limits, what are those limits? What are you hitting? Let's dig in on these things and really find out what they can do and what they can live up to. Although if YouTube videos are to be believed, they're smashing it out of the park. Apple is just doing a fabulous job here. And it sounds like even with compatibility, which would be one of the major concerns that I would have, it's doing great with Rosetta and with the other technologies that are in there. It is universal binaries. It's just performing incredibly well. So super exciting times to be an Apple fan and a Mac fan. And I'm looking forward to more and more of your comments. Of course, you know that we're in a little bit of a transition right now, also with our operating systems. I think I talked about on the last episode of MacCast, I'm not one to jump in with my production Mac, the thing I used for podcasts, into a new operating system very quickly. So I usually wait a month or two for kind of things to pan out. But I know there's a lot of folks in our community who are upgrading. And I received an email from Mike, who wrote in to ask, hey, how do I manually move podcasts, my podcast library, from Mojave to Big Sur if I want to do a clean install. And actually, we're going to talk a little bit more about clean installs later. I'm getting a lot of questions on clean installing. This usually happens when a new operating system comes out. But with Mike's question, you know, that was a great question, because the podcast app or podcast no longer live inside the media folder inside iTunes. So like back in the day, it was pretty easy. You just copy over the iTunes media folder and all your podcasts came with it. But now there's no iTunes because Apple separated it into the podcast app. So I didn't know how to answer this question, to be honest, Mike. I had no idea what the answer would be. And so, you know, obviously when you migrated from, if you had migrated to macOS Catalina, I guess I should say, what would have happened if you did an over-the-top install is all of the libraries and files and things would have been migrated for you. So they would already be moved over to the podcast app. I would assume the same thing would happen if you were doing an over-the-top install from Mojave to Big Sur. But to do a manual transition, I'm not really sure how you would do that. Also, just a side note, because of your email, I did go in and kind of look at some things related to podcasts in macOS Catalina on my Mac, and I noticed that some of my saved podcasts, specifically my first appearance on Leo Laporte's Tech Guy show, which I think I did at a podcast expo, was lost in the shuffle. I had been saving that episode because I didn't want to lose the audio for it. I don't know if I can go out and find another copy of it. And somehow, poof, that is actually just gone. So that didn't even make my migration, which is a little bit unfortunate and a little bit frustrating for me. But side note, let's get back to your question. So the question is, you know, if you're going to manually migrate those files, where are they stored? So I went on a little bit of a hunt to figure out where those went, and it turns out they are stored as quote-unquote cache files in a folder in the library folder in the home folder, in your home folder. So in the library folder, there's a folder called Group Containers, and then there's just this cryptic folder in there, 243LU875E5.groups.com.apple.podcasts. And the files are actually stored in that folder, but not with the podcast names or anything like that. They're just all under cryptic names. So really, Apple doesn't want you to get in there. And yes, this even includes downloads. So all of the files are stored in there. You can't just grab and drag a podcast file into that folder and have it show up in the podcast app. It doesn't work like that. You can drag podcasts out of the podcast app, like just open up the podcast app, grab a podcast from the download list and drag it onto your Mac, and that will work. It'll create an audio file, but you cannot go reverse. You can't drag them into the app. You can't drag them into that library folder. None of that. So as far as manually migrating it, I am not really sure. I guess the one thing that you could try is to just take that entire directory in that group containers folder inside the library folder. So 243LU875E5.groups.com.podcasts.apple.podcasts. Take that whole entire directory and move it from your old backup into your new one. But in your case, it sounds like you had not done the transition yet. So I'm not really sure you can do it going straight from Mojave to Big Sur. I think you're going to have to actually use Migration Assistant or some other tool to actually have your library converted over to the new podcast format, unfortunately, unless I'm totally missing something. I didn't find anything, but maybe some of you out in the community have a thought or a suggestion or have been able to successfully manually migrate podcasts from an old Mac running still iTunes with podcasts over to the new podcast app. If you do know how to do that, let us know how you did it, because then I can pass that information on to Mike. And plus, I just like to learn myself. So maybe there's a trick out there. I don't know how to do it, but there's a little bit more information there for you, Mike. So maybe that'll help you out. Let me know. maccast@gmail.com. So something else that came up this week, you know, we have a lot of devices in our lives now. If you're like me, you've got an iPhone, you've got an iPad, you've got an Apple Watch, you've got a couple Macs, you got some HomePods, you got I don't know how many Apple products I have in this house. It's a little bit crazy, to be honest. But hey, I do a show called The MacCast, so maybe that's to be expected. But yeah, we get a lot of notifications, and sometimes it can be a little bit overwhelming. But actually, I received a question from Graham this week, and he's looking for notifications to be a little bit more. I don't know if intrusive is the right word, but he wants to get notified definitely all the time, every time on every device. So I'll just let him tell you what he's looking for.
Hi Adam, listener Graham here from Portland, Oregon, with a question about notifications on both the Mac and iOS. I'm using multiple Mac computers throughout the course of the day, and I really rely on notifications to help me stay on track and on schedule all day long. Now, I know that Apple notifications will sound a notification if it sees that I'm on a particular computer. So if I'm typing on a particular Mac, that alert's going to appear right on that desktop. If I'm not typing on a computer, then I'll get that alert on my iPhone. But here's the problem. Because I use so many different computers during the day, the Apple notification system is getting confused about which one I'm actually working on. So I'll be down in the kitchen and I'll hear an alert sound back up in the office, despite the fact that I'm not there, and I'll get no notification when I'm on my iPhone that's right on my hip. Other times, my iPhone will be in the bedroom and I'll hear a ding on that alert, and I'll get no notification on the computer that I'm typing on at that moment. So I've been looking for a way that I can get notifications on all of the devices that I have. If I can just get everything to ring, then maybe I'll be able to hear it. I've missed a lot of meetings and text messages because of this problem, and I'm hoping you might be able to explain, first of all, how Apple handles notifications for multiple devices. I'd also appreciate any suggestions that you might have on how I could fix this problem. Thanks again for your help. I've been a listener since the beginning, and I really appreciate all the hard work you put into the show. It's fantastic. Thanks again.
Hey Graham, explaining Apple notifications. I don't know. That's like black box magic, I think. That doesn't really work. Yeah, I can't really explain how it works because it kind of doesn't work all the time, like you're noting, or at least not always the way you would want or expect it to work. So I don't know if I'm going to even try to answer that question. I did a little bit of research and it didn't seem very obvious to me. Apple doesn't really go into an explanation, but I did try playing around with this, and at least as far as sounds go, like getting the audible alerts, it does seem to be very, very inconsistent to me. I tried changing a bunch of settings, seeing if I could get notifications to sound on multiple Apple devices. I couldn't do it. I couldn't find a rhyme or reason as to why one would get a sound and one wouldn't get a sound. It did seem to be related to the screen being on and having attention. So when your iPhone is just sitting there on your hip, you may or may not get the audible alert, which seems a little bit odd to me. I don't really know. If I get a notification or a sound alert, a vibration on the Apple Watch, for example, what would happen is I get the alert on my Apple Watch, but not on my iPhone. So I don't know if that's because I have an Apple Watch and that's a more immediate or connected device, like it's physically touching my person versus the iPhone just might be near me. The iPhone seemed to not have sound if the lock screen was locked or even unlocked, or if it was asleep, even with the ringer being on. I'm not really sure what that was all about. Like I said, the Apple Watch seemed to be the preference. And if I was actively using my iPhone, then I would get the audio and the alert. So I don't know if that's because I have the attention option turned on, so where you need to be like looking at the screen and it'll detect that your attention is on your iPhone using the TrueDepth camera system. So maybe that has something to do with it. On the Mac, it seemed to be, again, if the Mac was awake and I was actively using it, then I would get the alert. So I don't know if there actually is a way to force the alert sound to happen on all of your devices all of the time. But maybe folks in the community know how to do it, or if there is some trick. as far as things you could play around with, I would say you could play around with the settings in notifications to see if making some changes help. One thing that you might do, especially for important notifications like those texts or emails or calendar information, that may help is changing how the banners work. So setting those alerts on to be alerts rather on the Mac and to be persistent on iOS. So that means instead of just being a banner that sort of flashes up and then goes away, it will actually leave that message up until you acknowledge it. So that way, at the very least, if you don't get the audio notification, when you go to unlock your device or unlock your Mac, it's going to be right there up on the screen and you're not actually going to miss the alert. So that's something I think you could probably try. Just a few other tricks to know about related to notifications and something you might want to check. I don't think you would have accidentally turned this on, but there is a deliver quietly option on iOS devices for notifications that come up on the lock screen. So if you're on the lock screen and you see a notification, you can swipe to the left and you will, as you're doing that, get some options. One of the options is manage. And if you tap on manage to manage the notification from the lock screen, what you will see are from the notification center as well. What you will see is an option to deliver quietly. And if you choose that option, that means that alert will only appear in notification center, not anyplace else. So it won't show the banner. It won't show on the lock screen. It won't make a sound. It won't have an app badge icon, none of that. It will only be available in Notification Center. So you can turn that on to kind of silence some notifications for a while and just have them go away. So you might look at that and make sure that it doesn't say deliver prominently as the option, because if it shows that, that's how you actually undo the deliver quietly option. So that's something to be aware of and know about and to probably check. A few other notification settings that you can look into, you know, allowing notifications for the app. So turning that on or off, obviously you're going to want to make sure that's on for your important ones. You have the different styles that we talked about. You can have it appear on the lock screen, the notifications in the notification center, or as a banner. You probably want to set all three of those on for your important notifications. The banner style, which can be temporary or persistent. So if it's temporary, it's just going to flash up and go away. Persistent, it stays there until you click OK or you interact with it. You've got sound and badge options. Also, the preview options, whether to show previews all the time, only when unlocked or never. And then how you want to group your notifications, either automatically by app or off. So there's a bunch of notification settings, obviously, that you can play around with. I think the key ones you're going to want to look into are allowing notifications, make sure obviously those are on, the styles and the sound badge options and banner types and those sorts of things. So play around with the settings, see what you can do. And again, maybe folks in the community might have a better answer than I have been able to give for your question. So if you do and you think you can help Graham out, shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. Rick wrote in this week and he got a new Mac and has been taking screenshots and noticed that his screenshots are much larger. I'm guessing, Rick, you got a new Mac with maybe a higher resolution display, and that's what's causing your screenshots to be a little bit larger. But he asked a great question. He said, you know, typically when I take a screenshot now, the screenshot sizes are between 1 megabyte and 6 megabytes. I'd really like to have those be a little bit smaller. So is there a way that I can get smaller sized screenshots in terms of not the physical size of the screenshot? He still wants the whole screen, but the file size. Can I get that file size down so it's not so big, not taking up so much room? And Rick, I immediately thought of a couple of options that you could use to get smaller screenshots. One is, I don't know if you always need the entire screen. So I don't know if you're just doing Command-Shift-3, which is the keyboard shortcut that takes a screenshot of your entire screen, or if you're doing it through the Screenshots app and just taking the entire screen. But if you don't need the entire screen, a way to get a smaller screenshot would be use the alternate option, Command-Shift-4, which is going to give you a little cursor crosshair and allow you to make a selection over the actual area that you want to take a screenshot of. So just taking a portion of that might be a way to cut down those screenshot sizes. Another thing you could do is you could take your screenshots as they're taken natively, open them up in the preview application, so just open them up in preview, and then re-export them as JPEGs, because out of the box on the Mac, the default file format is PNG, and PNGs tend to be a little bit larger. They don't have the same kind of compression options that JPEGs have, and what's nice about doing the JPEG export in preview is you can actually adjust the quality level, and it will show you the size of the file that it's going to generate, so you can crank that down pretty easily to, say, 500K and get those screenshots down to a more manageable size just by changing the JPEG quality. You'll lose a little bit of resolution. You might gain a little bit of artifacting, but maybe that'll be okay for the kinds of screenshots that you're taking. And of course, you can play around with settings and get the most optimal settings that you want. And then lastly, a lot of people don't know this because it's a little bit trickier and you have to not be afraid to run some terminal commands, but you can actually change the default format of the screenshot from PNG to JPEG. Again, JPEG is going to have some image compression applied, so in general, JPEG files are going to be a little bit smaller than PNG files. And so you can open up the terminal app, you can run a couple different terminal commands. I'll have those commands in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, you use those default write commands to change the screen type to JPEG. And if you ever want to change it back, it's pretty simple. You can just change the JPEG option in that command to a PNG option and switch it right back. So you can play around with it, see if that works for you, and that will get your screenshots a little bit smaller in size. So I hope that helps you out. But it also, your question got me thinking about screenshots, and I don't think we've talked about screenshot tips and tricks on the MacCast in a little while, so I thought we'd go through some of those again. I already mentioned one of them, the keyboard shortcut for taking a screenshot on the Mac, Command-Shift-3. That takes a full screenshot. I already talked about the other option, Command-Shift-4, which lets you have a cursor so you can make a selection on the screen and take a screenshot of that. But another tip with the Command-Shift-4 option is if you tap the space bar, the crosshair will turn from a crosshair into a little camera icon. And with the camera icon up, what you can do is you can hover over different elements on the screen, say your dock or a window or the menu bar, whatever it might be, and it will highlight just that portion. And then when you click to take your screenshot, it will capture just that highlighted portion of the screen. So I use that all the time to take quick snapshots or screenshots of an individual window, and then I don't have to recrop it or worry about where my crops are to get the exact shot that I need. Now, another one that a lot of people don't know about is there is a Command-Shift-5, and what this actually does is open up the screenshot app on your Mac, because taking screenshots is actually done via an app, via an application on the Mac. If you go into Applications Utilities Screenshot, you can open the app from there. But again, keyboard shortcut is Command-Shift-5. When you do that, you're going to get a little hovering command bar with some additional options. So it gives you the ability to do a timed screenshot. Really cool thing is you can change the location of where your screenshots are saved. So I think by default, they're saved on the desktop, but maybe you want to save them to a different location. So even a custom location, I changed mine so that it actually saves to a screenshots folder in my documents folder. And that way I don't have a bunch of screenshots cluttering up my desktop, but it does have a few other default locations where you can save your screenshots to. So you can play around with those settings. You can choose to show the floating thumbnail or not. So that's the new feature in macOS. When you take a screenshot, it'll put a little floating version down in the lower left corner. If you click on that, it'll bring it up in preview, and you can do things like markup and all those other options before you actually save the screenshot off. So you can turn that option on or off if you don't like that. And there's also an option to remember the last selection of all your different options. So you can either have the options affect a single screenshot and then go back to their defaults, or if you turn on the remember last selection option, any of the options that you change, like setting a timer, will remain selected for every screenshot you take from that point forward. Another thing that's nice about this little command bar is it gives you pretty easy access to actually take a video screencast as well. So you can grab video, not just a single image. So some great things there to play around with, and maybe you learned something you didn't know about before. I will give you one other screenshot tip, because this one comes up frequently too. Many of you know, if you take a screenshot of a Safari web page, it's only going to take a screenshot of what's visible on the screen. But a lot of times you have a web page that scrolls vertically and has a lot more content. I get the question all the time, how do I take a screenshot of the entire web page? And of course, there's some great third-party apps that can do that, but turns out there's actually a way to do it built into Mac OS, and it's using the developer menu in Safari. Now, this might not work with all web pages, but I've played around with it, and it works for most web pages. You do have to get a little bit down into the code, but it's not too tricky. I think I can walk you through it. So the first thing you need to do is turn on the developer menu in Safari. So open up Safari, go into Preferences, click on the Advanced tab, and then check on the Show Developer Menu in Menu Bar option. At that point, you'll have a new developer or develop menu in the menu bar. So then to capture a screenshot of an entire web page, go to the web page you want to capture the screenshot for, click in the developer menu and choose Show Inspector. That's going to bring up a little dialogue either at the bottom of the screen or in a floating window. And that's going to look a little bit daunting. It's going to have a bunch of developer options. But what you want to do is you'll see the code for the web page in that window, and you want to look for the HTML tag. So it has a set of greater than or less than brackets around it if you've never seen HTML code before. But look for the tag that says HTML and then control click or right click on that tag. And then in the contextual menu that comes up, you should see an option that says capture screenshot. When you click on that, it will pop up a save dialog box, ask you where you want to save the screenshot. You can save it to whatever location you want, and it will actually take a screenshot of the entire web page. So, like I said, a little bit trickier than just using a third-party tool. If this seems a little bit daunting to you, there are a lot of great third-party apps that deal with this issue, and you can find them on the Mac App Store. Just do some searching or search in Google, and you'll find them right away. But if you want to do it natively, here is a method for doing that. And I think I learned that from a video tip over on MacMost. They have some great YouTube videos that if you need some more Mac tips and tricks, you might want to check out. Gary over there does a great job. So there you go. Some screenshot tips and tricks. And thank you, Rick, for sending in your email. I mentioned at the top of the show, anytime a new OS comes out, inevitably I start to get a lot of questions surrounding doing a clean installation of Mac OS. And I have to be honest with you, this was a thing that we used to cover on the MacCast probably a few years back. You may or may not have noticed that in more recent years, I haven't really covered doing clean installations of Mac OS. And frankly, that's because now I haven't found them particularly necessary. It used to be back in the day, you know, your Mac would kind of get gunked up with a bunch of stuff and kind of cluttered up. These days, I think Apple's doing a little bit better job in the transitions. Of course, we can still get some cruft and things like that, but it tends not to impact the day-to-day usage of the Mac, especially ever since we've gone to SSDs and those sorts of things. I don't know. I personally don't see beach balls as much. I don't have as many issues. A lot of that stuff seems to have been sorted out. And I think at this point, it's a little bit easier to just declutter and do some house cleaning on your system than to do a full clean install. So if you've cluttered up your system over the years, you know, I think the reverse approach, rather than doing a clean install, I think it's almost easier to just take an inventory of what you have and then use some great tools like Clean My Mac X from MacPaw. Of course, they're a sponsor here on the MacCast, but I've been using them long before they were a sponsor. It is great software, and it has some really great tools in it. Things like their uninstaller, which can help you weed out and get rid of all of the app cruft. A lot of times, that's the stuff that you're trying to get rid of. Is like when you're doing a clean install, you're trying to get rid of all those old apps that you don't use anymore. And a lot of us know if you just take the app out of the app folder and throw it away like Apple wants you to, it leaves a bunch of junk behind in your user folder. System preferences, application support files, there's a bunch of stuff, and a lot of people don't know where to go to look for that stuff. The uninstaller in Clean My Mac X takes care of that. You just literally drag the app in there or select the app out of the uninstaller. It'll go find all the little bits and pieces of that app and get them off of your system. As far as like large files, forgotten files, old files, all those things, it has the Space Lens tool, which can help you locate those things by size and drilling down into the different areas of your Mac, or you can just run through their larger old file scanner. As a matter of fact, Mac OS has that built into it as well. If you go to About My Mac, you go into Storage and then Manage Storage, they have a system for helping you find large and old files that you may have forgotten. And of course, there's other great third-party tools for this as well, Daisy Disk and Grand Perspective. I'll have links to all these in the show notes at maccast.com, so you don't have to worry about writing those down. But there are just a lot of good, easy ways to kind of clean the clutter on your Mac. And so at this point, I really think the only reason to do a full clean install is really if you're having a lot of issues with your current installation. So, you know, if you're seeing a lot of beach balls, if you're getting a lot of crashing, kernel panics, all those sorts of things, and you just haven't done it in years and years and years, then yeah, maybe it's time to try a clean install. And I won't go into a lot of the specific details, but I thought I'd cover at least the basic steps for you, again, because I get this question a lot. So the very first step, if you're planning a clean install, because you're going to ultimately erase your internal hard drive, your boot hard drive on your Mac, the first step is backup, backup, backup. Now, because you're a MacCast listener, I know you're probably already doing this, but I just need to reiterate, make sure you have multiple backups, at least two, because again, the minute you erase your internal drive, if you only have one backup, you now have zero backups because that backup becomes the only copy of all of your information. So that's not a backup. You need to have at least two versions, and I would really advise that you have three. So I usually do a Time Machine backup and then also some sort of clone backup, either with SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner, and I have both of those handy and ready to go before I do a clean install. So backup is the very first step. Next step is to create a bootable installer of the OS that you want to install onto. So if it's macOS Big Sur, you want to create a USB stick bootable installer. Apple has a support article on how to do this on their website. I will link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. Basically, you're going to have to get yourself a USB drive and thumb drive and then run some terminal commands. So the support article will walk you through it. It's not too crazy, and you can easily do it yourself. So build that bootable installer. Then you're going to boot from that installer and erase your Mac's hard drive with the disk utility. And then you're going to use that installer drive to install a new clean version of the operating system. So that is the clean install at that point. At that point, you basically have a Mac just with an operating system on it. And now's where it gets tricky. And it's gotten tricky because Apple has made a lot of changes at the operating system level and with system protection and a bunch of other things with how things are done, where things are installed. I mean, we talked about it with the whole podcast app earlier, right? they've made it pretty hard to figure out where your files and folders and information are. So you could go through and methodically copy all that stuff back over to the Mac. That's kind of how we did it in the old days. And that was when Migration Assistant was a little bit funky and not really that great. This day and age, I would say probably the easier thing to do is just use Migration Assistant to restore at least your user account. And really, I would say that's the only thing. If you're really looking to do a true clean install, just bring your user files back over. Or again, you could set it up from scratch and manually move your files one by one. But I would suggest using Migration Assistant because it's going to be the easiest. It's going to get all of your stuff. It's going to put it all in the right locations. Of course, that still means you might have to do some of the cleanup that we talked about earlier, because if you have old applications, it is going to bring over preferences and application support files, even though you don't have those apps installed anymore. That stuff really doesn't matter being in your drive, but if you're just the type of person that, hey, I need to clean that out, I don't want the clutter, I don't want it taking up the space, then you're going to have to deal with that if you use Migration Assistant. If you go the other route and just move it all manually, you're going to be okay with that. It's just, again, it's going to be a little bit trickier to figure out where everything goes. Google is your friend there. If you're going to go that route, just do some Google searching. I will tell you, I tried to find an article that talked about doing a clean install and walked you through all these locations. Like a big one is like, where is your mail, right? Where is that coming from? And Apple keeps moving the mail folders around. It's tricky to find out where mail files are supposed to be, believe it or not. So just use Migration Assistant. I think it's going to be a lot easier. I would use the custom options, so tell it what you want to migrate, say your user folder. I would probably not reinstall the apps or not migrate your apps. I would reinstall apps from scratch, because that way you can clean out your application folder pretty easily. And you might not even want to move over your system settings or your network settings. Of course, that means you're going to have to set all those up again from scratch. So make sure you have your network passwords handy, and be aware that all your system settings are going to be a little wonky till you reset them. And then, of course, with your applications, if you're going to reinstall your applications, you're going to need to know where all your app installers are. You're going to have to download new versions from the developers' websites. You're going to need to have all your license codes handy. That's why I really recommend getting a tool like 1Password or some other password manager that can also manage your software license keys and all those sorts of things. I keep all of mine in 1Password. So literally every time I've done a clean install, what I do is the very first app that I install is 1Password. And then I sync up my library, get that down from iCloud, and then I have access to all of my logins, all of my software license keys and what software I actually own, because that's also a great list to say, here's all the apps that I own. Which ones do I want to reinstall? Which ones am I not using anymore? Okay, I can skip those sorts of things. So I would do that. And then the last thing that I do is, remember those backups that we started with? I take one of those and I set it off to the side. I'll literally buy a new drive to do a new clone backup on my new operating system, just so I can keep my old operating system in a bootable version around. And that's in case, one, if something goes wrong, I can simply boot back into it. But more importantly, what I usually use that for is maybe I forgot to, especially if I manually migrate all of my user files back over, I might have forgotten a app or a set of preferences for an app or something like that, or the application support files for an app. I can go back to, when I realize that stuff is missing, I can go back to that backup and I can just migrate it over at that point. So, you know, you might not get everything migrated over right at once. You might want to do it in steps or go through it. So having that extra backup around is really, really handy. So that's the last thing that I would advise. So I know I didn't go real in-depth step-by-step on how to do a clean install, but hopefully that's enough information that you can figure it out on your own and you can make your own decision about how you want to migrate. But again, more and more these days, I'm just doing the over-the-top install and everything seems to be fine. And that's generally what I hear from the community, is like 90% of the time that's going to work for 90% of the people. Those outliers out there, yep, you might have to do a clean install. And again, hopefully this was enough information to help you out. All right, last thing that I have for you this week is a thing of the moment. And this also relates to Big Sur. I think maybe even for those of us who are not upgrading to Big Sur, at least not yet. And that is one of the things with Big Sur is Apple is kind of making a change to how app icons look, at least for their own built-in applications or their Apple applications. They're moving to a new square icon format. So icons on the Mac are looking a lot more like icons on iOS. And to be fair, or honest, I guess I should say, I'm not a big fan. And the reason is it started doing this, my app started doing this to me on macOS Catalina. So app developers are updating their apps for Big Sur, and as they're doing it, they're adopting this new square icon format. And so it's changing the look of the icons in my dock, and I'm not really liking it too much because it's now inconsistent. And so the thing of the moment this week kind of deals with that. It gets the same aesthetic into your apps, even if the app developer hasn't updated their icon yet. And in my case, it's Apple who hasn't updated the icons, obviously, in the versions of their apps that are running on anything prior to Big Sur. So what the site is, it's macosicons.com, and it will give you a little bit more consistency by allowing you to have a set of icons, app icons, that you can replace your existing icons with. So you can get them all into the square format. And they have almost 3,000 icons at this point in the ICN format. And that's the key there, is the files need to be in this ICN format. And they've kind of opened it up to anybody to be able to create icons and submit them. And so far, I haven't found a single app that I use that doesn't have an icon on macosicons.com. So it's really, really cool. They even have some alternate designs for some of your favorite apps. So maybe, you know, the icon that the developer put together is not your favorite and you want to change it up a little bit. You'd rather have something a little more consistent or just a little bit different. You can find an alternate icon as well. So you can go on the website, you can find the icon for your favorite apps, and then as far as how to customize it, it's really pretty easy. All you have to do is download the icon file, again in the ICNS format. Then go to your applications folder in the Finder, select the application you want to change the icon for, do Command I or File Get Info to bring up the file info dialog, and then simply drag the custom icon over the image, or over the icon image, excuse me, in the upper left hand corner of the dialog, and that will swap out the icon. Now, if that application is in your dock, you will not see the application icon in the dock change until the next time you launch that application. So if the application's already open, you're going to have to quit the app and relaunch it. If you haven't launched the app yet, the next time you launch that application, it will pick up and display the new icon in the dock. So really cool stuff. I will tell you that a lot of people have been talking about macosicons.com. The site has gotten very, very popular, and the original developer that put it together is struggling with his server costs. The server costs are going up dramatically. So if you do end up using this tip and you like the icons, consider making a donation or sponsoring the developer so he can help pay that server bill. But macosicons.com is the cool thing for this week. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I'd like to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave a voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or find me on Instagram, MacCast on Instagram. And with that, that'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.